Straight from the source tonight, a new war over Donald Trump's gag order. Prosecutors argue that it covers the judge's daughter that he's been attacking, while Trump's legal team says it doesn't. A new reaction to our exclusive interview with a sitting federal judge, raising alarms that Trump's attacks on the judicial system could lead to tyranny. And also tonight, Trevor Reed is here, the former Marine who was once held captive by Vladimir Putin, now fighting to help free other U.S. citizens, including Evan Gershkovich, who was jailed in Russia exactly 1 year ago today. I'm Caitlin Collins, and this is The Source. A private fight has exploded into public view tonight between Donald Trump and the prosecutors who could be the first to make him a convicted felon. The Manhattan District Attorney's Office is now strongly implying that Trump is violating that gag order that was placed on him just days ago by the judge here in New York in his hush money criminal case when Trump attacked Judge Juan Merchan's daughter. Let's get right to former federal prosecutor and CNN legal analyst Elliot Williams tonight. Because, Elliot, when you read through this, the district attorney's office is essentially asking the judge to clarify his gag order. What do you think they mean by that? And what's their argument that Trump did violate it?
You know, to be honest, Caitlin, by clarify it, they mean add terms to it. The simple fact is the language of the gag order specifically does not mention sort of additional people beyond a certain sort of enumerated folks. And they're using the terms sort of, I think it was clarify and there was one other term. But they're really asking for a new gag order. And I think that's the question that the judge has to answer here. Or, you know, are we merely construing the language of this gag order to apply to family members of judges, or are we just adding terms to it, in which case the judge can rescind the gag order and just issue a new one?
Well, Trump's team seems to be saying, no, the reading of it since this came out has been that it doesn't include the judge, it doesn't include the district attorney, and it doesn't include the judge's daughter. But they also, I noticed at the end of their response, seemed to be saying kind of a justification for Trump's attacks on Judge Juan Merchan's daughter.
They do. And look, and they also go with a little bit of a dig about the political work that she has done professionally. Now, look, I think there's no rational universe in which we think that defendants ought to be able to start going after the family members of court personnel. But if that's the case, then the judge should have put that in the order in the first place. And now they're in this odd space where they have a gag order that does not specifically mention this class of individual and are now having a party asking to sort of construe the language of it to be brought in there. So it's a little bit of a stretch. I think they can work this out, but, you know, the Trump folks do have a point that the prosecutors are asking to add terms to a gag order that simply are just not there.
Yeah, we'll see what the judge himself decides to do here. No easy position to be in. Elliot Williams, thank you for that. And with that as the very important backdrop to what is happening, to what we are witnessing, it's something unprecedented. And it's in response to this: Donald Trump relentlessly attacking one of the pillars of our democracy as he is facing that first criminal trial that is going to start just 17 days from now. The once and potentially future most powerful person in the world is doing what he clearly relishes, using his words as weapons to potentially hurt people, not just the powerful like judges and prosecutors, but also private citizens facing his wrath. And this time he went so far over the line, he's now on the receiving end of a really extraordinary rebuke. It happened here last night on The Source, an extremely rare television interview with a sitting federal judge, something you never see. And based on the intense response to that interview, senior U.S. District Judge Reggie Walton clearly struck a nerve.
It's very disconcerting to have someone making comments about a judge, and it's particularly problematic when those comments are in the form of a threat, especially if they're directed at one's family.
Judge Walton knows from experience. He himself and also his daughter have been the target of threats simply because he's on the bench. And for him, he told me that it's only gotten worse since he's now been overseeing some of the January 6th trials. Just as an aside here, and for those who were critics of him coming out and speaking, this is a federal judge who is used to dealing with some of the most high-profile cases. In his 42 years on the bench, he's presided over the trial of then-Vice President Dick Cheney's chief of staff, Scooter Libby, the Roger Clemens trial, arguments over Whitewater, Guantanamo Bay, the Mueller report. He was nominated or appointed to his judgeships by Republican presidents, Reagan and both Bushes, 41 and 43. That's who Judge Reggie Walton is. So hearing him say this carries a lot of weight.
The rule of law can only function effectively when we have judges who are prepared to carry out their duties without the threat of potential physical harm. If we don't have a viable court system that's able to function efficiently, then we have tyranny.
Strong words there from Judge Walton, who also, I should note, in our interview, made a point not to directly attack Trump or weigh in on any of the specific cases. He actually never once said Donald Trump's name. But he did emphasize the responsibility that someone like Donald Trump has to know how his words can upend lives. Look no further than Ruby Freeman and her daughter, Shae Moss. You'll remember them as the Georgia election workers, simply doing their civic duty in 2020. They ended up in the crosshairs of Trump's lies about a stolen election that wasn't.
There is nowhere I feel safe. Do you know how it feels to have the president of the United States to target you?
My next guest is someone who knows exactly what it's like to be targeted by Donald Trump. He was one of the five teenagers wrongly accused of raping a jogger in New York's Central Park in 1989. After that attack, then-businessman Donald Trump took out this full-page ad in several of the city's papers that read, quote, "Bring back the death penalty. Bring back our police." Except, as we now know, the Central Park Five didn't do it. They were exonerated in 2002. Yusuf Salam, one of the exonerated five and now a New York City council member, is here with me tonight. And I'm so glad you're here because as someone who knows what it's like for Donald Trump to attack you, I mean, you were 16 years old at the time, I should remind everyone. What's it like to see him doing what he's doing now 35 years later?
You know, when I think about a person like Donald Trump who is using his power to influence judgment, you know, I follow a faith as a Muslim that tells us that we shouldn't use our power to influence judgment. And here it is, 35 years ago for me, 1989, what he did by placing that ad in New York City's newspapers had a domino effect where people, the way I describe it really is that it was a whisper into the darkest enclaves of society for them to do to us what they had done to Emmett Till. We have a long history of oppression in this country when it comes to black people in general. And when I think about a person like Donald Trump who's in power, who's trying to use influence, his influence to affect the outcome of elections, to be a person who says, look at this shiny apple and that be a sneaker, or any of the other things, you know, that whisper, that influence that causes people to say, well, I'll take care of it, and hope. And I'm saying the people that do this hope that they will garner the favor of a president that is moving tyrannical like that.
And you talked about in that moment how he was, it felt like he was kind of directing people toward you and you were scared. You were at home. You're with your families. You're 16 years old. I mean, you brought this letter tonight that you got from an anonymous person. Could you just read it for me to share what someone said to me?
You know, I carry this with me as a reminder that I can't live in fear. I have to live full so that I can die empty. But this letter right here says, the Lord will punish Yusuf for what he did to that poor, defenseless girl. And then directing their attention to my mother, you will also be punished for raising such an animal. He does not deserve to live, and neither do you. Folks sent this to us. They sent us letters like this. I have a whole billfold full of them. And it was all on the heels of that ad that Donald Trump placed in New York City's newspapers. Even folks like Pat Buchanan said, well, let's just take Corey Wise and hang him from a tree in Central Park. And he was urging us to do this by June 1st.
And they sent that to your house?
Yes.
I mean, it makes your stomach turn to think of you as a 16-year-old, knowing you didn't do this, reading that, and for your mom to have to read that.
You know, the worst part is that my mother did read this, and she kept this away from me. I didn't even know this was in my apartment for the whole time that I was in prison, I came home to a box of letters that I had sent my mother, and attached to them was a little stack of mail that contained all of these letters. And as I read them, the first thing I thought was how strong my mother could have been to still continue forward, unafraid, unapologetic, standing up for herself, standing up for me, standing up for my brother and my sister. And she's always been like that. And I think that that's the real strength of what these types of things potentially can do. But when you push back, that fear that they're trying to posit inside of you is false evidence appearing real.
And it must make you, I mean, to think of the judge's daughter here. She's she worked for Democratic campaigns, but she's being targeted by name by Donald Trump, as y'all were as well. I mean, there was this moment from Trump back then as a businessman, and I just want to remind people the kind of things that he was saying about y'all.
Do I have hatred for them? And I said, look, this woman was raped, mugged, and thrown off a building. Thrown off a building on top of everything else. She's virtually, I mean, she's got some major problems, to put it mildly. I said, of course I hate these people. And let's all hate these people, because maybe hate is what we need if we're going to get something done.
I think just listening to that, I think of the power he had then, now, the influence as this, you know, big shot business guy in New York. But to now, I mean, he's a former president who may be president again.
Wow. You know, I'm lost for words. But unfortunately, and I hate to say this, this is as American as apple pie. This is America. When we look at the history of America, when we look at the fact that good people have tried to advance us into becoming a United States of America, and there are people that continue to divide us, that continue to make sure that even though we're in the melting pot of the kaleidoscope of the human family, that there's great opportunity here for us to be able to thrive. But yet, oppression keeps the foot or the knee or the hand around our necks, disallowing us to really reach the full potential. When people use their influence and power to keep people afraid to even stand up or say anything, and even directing that vitriol at their family members who have nothing to do with anything associated with the judgment, this is where the real problem lies. And I think we need more good people to do the right thing, to ensure, in fact, and really to know that you will be protected by the hedge of God, that you are here to do a very specific thing. And even in a country that says you're innocent until proven guilty, I didn't get that opportunity. And so when I talked about Donald Trump hoping that he received all of the legal remedies associated with law, I talked about what I didn't receive, hoping that he would go through the process and get all that he is justly due.
You talk about people speaking out. Do you think Judge Reggie Walton, by coming out and doing something that no federal judge really ever does, and just talking about the threats and that they're real, and that his fear was, he said, any reasonable thinking person would appreciate the impact that rhetoric like what Trump is using has on people.
This is not a game. You know, at the end of the day, for a person to be as courageous as he, to stand up and talk about what's at stake, we need to understand this. We're lay people watching this. This is almost like a TV show, a program. But the truth of the matter is that we are watching this, and at the same time, we are seeing someone courageous say, this is what we're facing every day when we try to uphold the law. There's so many people who are trying to keep us in the dark. But that true fight that we're fighting is against spiritual wickedness in high and low places. And so we have to continue to just try to add more light so that that darkness dissipates. That's what this is all about.
Yusuf Salam, I always appreciate hearing from you.
My pleasure. Thank you
for coming on to put that in perspective for us.
Thank you as well.
We'll have much more on this ahead, and really what this moment means in a historical sense. After this, plus Marine veteran Trevor Reed is also going to join us. He's a former Russian detainee as well. He'll talk about the fight to bring home the American journalist Evan Gershkovich, who has now been wrongfully detained in Russia for exactly 1 year.
I'm Dr. Sanjay Gupta, CNN's chief medical correspondent. This week on Chasing Life,
lately, we have been paying attention to a very different virus, bird flu, which is caused by the H5N1 virus. If you start to hear that it's circulating in pigs, that would be a concern.
That means I would go from sleeping with one eye open to one and a half eyes open. Yeah, that would make me very concerned.
Listen to Chasing Life, wherever you get your podcasts.
We've been reflecting tonight about the state of our democracy and those warnings from a sitting federal judge about how former President Trump could upend it. I want to turn now to presidential historian Mark Updegrove to shed light on just what this moment means, how historic it is. And Mark, it's great to have you here to just kind of look at this moment where, you know, we're seeing a former president, the presumptive nominee, who obviously could easily win back the White House, and how he's targeting this judge and, more importantly, the judge's daughter that we've been talking about in this case. I wonder if any of this, based on what you look at in the past, if any of it surprises you.
Well, it's shocking on its face, but it's not surprising if you know the behavior of Donald Trump, Caitlin. I mean, this is somebody who employs tactics to his own end. He employs these scorched earth tactics when they suit him. James Comey, when he was fired as FBI director by Trump early in Trump's term, likened Trump to a mob boss. And this is the kind of behavior we see not from a president or former president, but from a mafia boss. I mean, it's something you see in a movie about the mob, not from a former president. So in that respect, it's shocking. But we've always had demagogues rise up balefully in American life. In the 20th century alone, we had Father Charles Coughlin and Joe McCarthy and George Wallace. But the difference is they didn't have the power of the presidency, and they didn't have a cult of personality surrounding them that Donald Trump has that almost makes him immune from criticism, at least among his base, for this kind of outrageous behavior, Caitlin.
Well, and the other side of that is that as Trump is doing this, you're hearing from people we typically wouldn't hear from. We would never hear from a sitting federal judge to come out and say what Judge Walton said last night, which is that, you know, these attacks on the judiciary aren't just happening in a vacuum, that he believes it could actually up in democracy, that it could result in tyranny if we can't have this effective judicial branch that isn't scared to do their jobs because they're facing threats of potential physical violence.
Well, John Adams, one of our founding fathers, called us a nation of laws and not men. We live by guiding rules and regulations. That is the basis of our society. A president puts his hand on the Bible and swears to abide by the Constitution, which is our set of rules. So he's absolutely right. If you don't have a respect for law in this country, you are holding our most basic democratic principles in contempt. We are a nation of laws and not men. And Donald Trump frequently talks about abiding by law and order, but he's often thumbs his nose at the law, at the rule of law, and disregards the disorder it causes, Caitlin.
Mark Updegrove, great to have you put this in perspective tonight. Thank you for joining us.
Thank you.
And as we talk about the importance of this moment, the fact that Donald Trump is the presumptive Republican nominee, we are learning new details tonight about that effort to get back in the White House and a billionaire breakfast that involved. And it could give Donald Trump a boost that he needs when it comes to what he is fundraising. We reported on Trump's private meeting with Elon Musk in Florida earlier this month. You'll remember that. But what we didn't know until now was who else was there. It turns out a whole bunch of other billionaires. The Washington Post reports that they were joined by Republican MAGA donor Nelson Peltz, the casino mogul Steve Wynn, and also the former Marvel chairman Isaac Perlmutter. Now, you may be wondering, why does it matter that a former president had breakfast with all these billionaires? Well, it does because of which particular billionaires it was. It was just 3 years ago that Peltz said that the January 6th Capitol was a disgrace and that he was sorry he had ever voted for Donald Trump. Now he tells the Financial Times he'll probably vote for him in November. He's not the only one. There are also a handful of other billionaires, according to the Washington Post in their new report, who are coming around on Trump. quietly throwing their support, but more importantly, their money, behind the former president. I want to bring in CNN political commentator Van Jones, who worked in the Obama administration, and CNN's senior political commentator Scott Jennings, who is a senior advisor to Mitch McConnell. And Scott, it does speak to the moment of, you know, what we are watching, this political comeback of Donald Trump's.
Yeah, it's pretty remarkable, actually. But I hate to break it to you guys, it's not just billionaires. I mean, if you look at the polling on what people say, whether they approve of Donald Trump's job versus Joe Biden's job in office, Donald Trump is in positive territory. People remember his years fondly because they're comparing it to Joe Biden's administration. And I think what's happening with these billionaires and other Republicans and donors is that they had no idea that Joe Biden was going to run an administration like this. He ran a campaign as a moderate deal maker, a transformational or transitional figure, and he's turned out to be a real ultra progressive president, probably the most liberal progressive president we've ever had. So I think that's why you're seeing people return to the fold for Donald Trump right now.
Well, but quickly on that, Scott, you know, none of us are billionaires on this panel that I'm aware of, at least. But the sense that they're doing it so quietly, don't you think it's also that they're just really wealthy and they want to be close to whoever is in power because it'll affect them and their money potentially?
Sure. I mean, I assume they're like any other. By the way, Van's closest if you're keeping score at home. But I assume they're like any other American voter. They're looking at this administration and saying, none of this is good for me. And maybe they're thinking it's not good for the country. And so they, like the rest of us, are probably casting around for which politician might be giving them the best deal based on what policy actions they would take. So I cannot underscore enough, though, there are Republicans who are deeply unsatisfied with Trump after January 6th, who are coming. This is happening across the board, who are coming back around based on what they've seen out of Biden. It is Biden's fault for being too ultra progressive and not being a more middle of the road president.
Van, what do you make of all this?
I love my brother Scott. I see it very differently. I don't know what ultra liberal president he's talking about. You have a bipartisan infrastructure bill, the CHIPS Act to keep China from destroying our technology capability, making sure we're strong here. I mean, which particular bill are you talking about? That most of them are passed on a bipartisan basis. And by the way, the economy feels bad for most people because food prices are stuck up too high and housing is too high. But the unemployment rate is low. Gas prices are comparatively low. The stock market is up. Like this idea that we're living through some hellscape with this crazy liberal president, and before with Donald Trump, everything was so wonderful. I just don't. We're living in different realities. I remember everybody waking up afraid to check their phone every morning because Donald Trump was going to do something else terrifying or crazy or norm busting. And I also remember him dropping the ball in the middle of the pandemic and putting us into one of the worst recessions we've ever had. So I don't know why these billionaires are doing what they're doing. I will say this. Donald Trump's ability to consolidate the support he's consolidating should scare the crap out of everybody. Because we've just spent the first 26 minutes of this show laying out a mobster-style approach to power on behalf of this person. And if he gets power again, none of the people who are around him right now will be safe. Ask the billionaires who supported Putin and who wound up in all kind of trouble. This is a troublesome, I had to defend my president, I had to defend our president, but this is a troublesome development. Some billionaires have more concern about their economic value than their democratic values.
Well, Van, I mean, on that note and what you just laid out, and Scott, I want to get your take on this too, but Van, first to you, the Washington Post, Politico, Jonathan Martin is reporting that in this moment, all of the people who, the Republicans who are not voting for Donald Trump, that are not supporting him and have made very clear, including on this show, that they will not be voting for him in November, Mitt Romney, Mike Pence, Susan Collins, Larry Hogan, Chris Christie, George W. Bush, none of them have heard from Joe Biden. Why is that? Do you think you should reach out to them?
Well, if he hasn't, I would call that political malpractice. We need the biggest, broadest tent possible. The pro-democracy forces, the anti-authoritarian forces include Republicans, Independent, Green Party, Libertarians, Democrats, and further to the left than Democrats all have an interest in making sure we don't have an authoritarian in the White House. And so if Biden has not reached out to them, it's still early tonight. I hope he'll pick up the phone and do it right now.
Scott, what do you think?
I think everything Joe Biden does is aimed at Democrats or people who consider themselves to be more liberal than Democrats. I think he does very little to nothing to aim at the middle of the country or the center right that you're talking about that could probably be had. He didn't do it in the State of the Union. They don't do it in their campaign messaging. Maybe they'll get there someday, but I don't see evidence of it so far.
We'll see if the progressives would disagree with you on that, but we'll see how this all shakes out. Van Jones, Scott Jennings, as always, great to have you on. Let me know when you become a billionaire. Other than that, moving on to our other big story of today. Today is important. The shirt that I'm wearing is a shirt that I'm wearing for a reason, because today marks 1 year since Evan Gershkovich has been Putin's prisoner. He's an American journalist, and we are now marking this grim milestone. Very few people know what he is going through, what it is like, but our next guest does, or he'll hear from Trevor Reed in just a moment.
The assignment with me, Audie Cornish.
So there have been arrests, suspensions, disciplinary hearings. They're shutting down graduation events.
At this moment, the part of the protests that are admirable are young people calling attention to atrocities.
Michael Roth is the president of Wesleyan University.
I would like to make a space for them to do that, as long as that space doesn't prevent other people from pursuing their education.
Listen to The Assignment with me, Audie Cornish, on your favorite podcast app.
Vladimir Putin is still trying to blame Ukraine tonight for last week's terror attack that killed at least 144 people near Moscow. Just today, Russia's investigative committee accused Kyiv of promising a reward to those who committed this attack. Moscow has been peddling that narrative that Ukraine was involved without offering any evidence, I should note. And as Putin has been ramping up his war effort, today also has another milestone. It marks 1 year since the Wall Street Journal reporter Evan Gershkovich was detained in Russia on espionage charges that the U.S. State Department says are baseless and fabricated. The Journal today paying tribute to its reporter, leaving an empty space on its front page today for Evan and his stolen stories. My next guest is really the only person who can talk about both of these topics, Trevor Reed, a U.S. Marine who was detained in a Russian prison for 3 years and now is thankfully back in the United States. And Trevor, I mean, you know what it's like. You have this idea, and you're one of these few people who's experienced this personally. And I wonder how you're kind of reflecting on this 1 year of Evan being wrongfully detained.
Yeah, I think the first year of detention is probably one of the most difficult. The first year that you're in there, you're kind of being bombarded with all these different experiences from. You know, this kind of denial that you have that it's actually happening, trying to organize and speak to your family, to the U.S. State Department, figuring out how to communicate, how to talk to the other prisoners, learning how the administration works. So there's a lot that you go through in that first year.
Well, and you know, we were at the Wall Street Journal, their newsroom, their bureau here in New York yesterday, talking to their journalists, just how they're processing it. And one of the parts of this, when you read Evan's reporting that he did for the Moscow Times, you know, he talked about people who are being held, getting their sentences extended by 15 days, by 30 days, and kind of the mental punishment you go through of not knowing, you know, how long it's going to be extended the next time.
Right. So at the beginning there, when you're in the they call it the Sledstveni Izolator, which means like the investigation isolator. Basically, your pretrial detention facility. You're being constantly every month at the beginning sent back to court to go have your time in prison extended. There's a chance in some of those courts that you could be given house arrest or bail. But it's all a facade. So unless you're someone who has an incredible amount of money to bribe the prosecutor or the judges with, you know, pretty much no one is given house arrest or bail. So, you know, they have that in their system to kind of show that they have a, you know, working judicial system, but it's a facade.
Well, and, you know, when you're not in that courtroom, he's in prison, and you spent a few days in the prison that he is being held in, and you described it once as the most sinister of all of the six prisons that you were in. I mean, what is it like inside of there?
So the conditions, I would say, in Lefortovo prison were probably a little bit better than a lot of the other prisons that I was in, but the atmosphere is completely different there. So that is an FSB prison, which is completely locked down. If you leave the cell, they've made sure that all of the other cells in the entire prison are closed so that you don't ever have any contact with any other prisoners. You don't ever see another prisoner. When you're taken out of the cell to go up to the top floor to do your, you know, your 1 hour walk around in a circle inside of another cell, there's no way to communicate with the other prisoners there. So unless you've been given a cellmate or something like that, very little communication with other human beings. The guards are not going to talk to you. The contractors who deliver food are not going to talk to you. And they censor all of your mail there. So all of that stuff is strictly controlled.
As someone who knows what it's like for your parents, you know, we know your parents, for the anguish that they were in as they waited for the Biden administration and for your release to be negotiated. I mean, what would you say, like, what's your message to the White House about what Evan's living through and the message to keep trying, basically?
I would say, you know, that I understand that these types of things can be difficult from a political perspective, obviously. You're going to receive criticism either way. If you do decide to do something and help, people are going to criticize you. If you don't, people are going to criticize you. But I think it comes down to making the ethical decision. And, you know, getting Evan out of there, getting Paul Whelan out, who's been in there now for 5 years and 3 months, and lots of other Americans who are wrongfully detained, I think that's not only the ethically correct thing to do, but, you know, that's also a duty that we have as an American. And as the president of the United States, I think that's, you know, something especially important. President Biden made the right decision to get me out of there. I know that was tough to make that decision. But, you know, I think he needs to continue to do that. And if he needs to, you know, impose costs on Russia for taking hostages, do that by all means, but still work on getting Americans home.
Trevor Reed, always grateful for your time.
Thank you.
Of course, we here at CNN agree with the Wall Street Journal that journalism is not a crime and that Evan should be brought home. And we will continue to follow that story. Ahead here tonight, we do have some major news coming out of that fundraiser we were talking about last night with all three presidents. Four presidents on stage making a joke that was teed up about Donald Trump by Stephen Colbert. We'll tell you what it was in a moment. There's an old saying in the news business: if your mother says she loves you, check it out. Meaning that everything you hear, you shouldn't just take at face value. You should double and triple check to make sure it's true. When you hear about Donald Trump's golf prowess,
Donald Trump, as far as we can tell, has just been trying to win a third championship at his own golf course. My question to you, sir, can voters trust a presidential candidate who has not won a single Trump International Golf Club trophy? At long last, sir, have you no chip shot?
Well, look, I'd be happy to play. I told him this before when he came into the Oval, when he was being, before he got sworn in. I said, I'll give you three strokes if you carry your own bag.
Stephen Colbert and President Biden there poking fun at Trump's expense last night at that star-studded fundraiser here in New York. The media wasn't allowed in, but the Biden campaign made sure that that moment got out. Joining me now is a man who wrote the book about Trump's golfing etiquette, or maybe he would say lack thereof. Commander in Chief, How Golf Explains Trump. And sports writer Rick Riley joins me now. And Rick, I mean, you have reported extensively on Trump's golf game. Can you just remind us what it's like to be on the golf course with him?
Well, he jerry-rigs his golf cart so it goes three times as fast as yours. And that's how he gets ahead of you by 200 yards, which allows him to kick it, boozle it, set it up. He has these green tees that when he's in the rough, he literally tees it up in the rough, which is, it's so far out of the realm of the rules. So he's always way ahead. He took with me the one time seven mulligans and a gimme chip in, which I'd never heard of. And then you always lose to him, even though you have no idea what you just went through.
You said you never heard of golf. What? You never heard of what that he does?
So, you know, when you play golf, you tee up the ball on the tee box, right?
Yeah.
Well, he orders thousands of these green, long green tees. So his caddies tee up his balls in the rough. So that it looks like he just hit a great shot out of the rough, but there's actually a tee there. I mean, the links, the guy's diabolical. I've never heard of some of the things he does to cheat. For instance, he says he's won 23 club championships. Well, do you remember that time he went to Diamond and Silk's funeral? I think it was in Alabama or something.
North Carolina.
It was a two-day tournament going on. Thank you. It was a two-day tournament going on in Florida. He missed one of the days. He came back, said he won the two-day tournament. And they said, how? And he said, well, I put in a really strong round earlier in the week.
I mean,
you know, I don't care about politics much, but I care about the game of golf. And he's leaving a big orange stain on the golf. And I'm afraid people are just going to turn away from it and think we all cheat. We don't cheat. This guy cheats.
Well, I mean, what about what about the other 22?
He's the worst.
What about the other 22 championships?
Okay, he told me how he won 12 of them. He said, what I do is when I buy a new course, I play the first round by myself, and then I'm the club champion. How do you beat that? He won one club championship, Caitlin, when he was in North Korea. They held one back in America, and some guy won it. And Trump sees him a month later and says, well, you didn't beat me, so you're not the champ. And suddenly, he was the champ. One time, he called in a score from Philly to a tournament and he was having at Bedminster and decided he was the champ. One time he walked in, missed the tournament completely. He looked at the guy who'd won on the trophy board, said, I beat that guy all the time. And they had to take this poor guy's name off and put his up. I mean, so it's nuts.
You're doubtful that he's winning championships, you know, beating golfers who are in their 20s and 30s when he's in his late 70s now.
Am I doubtful? I wrote a whole book about it. I couldn't find one single tournament that wasn't a complete sham. Now, just so you know, he's never won a tournament at a course that he didn't own and operate, right? So he's played in the Pebble Beach Pro-Am. He's played
Rick
in the Lake
Riley.
Tahoe Celebrity Challenge. He's never come close to it there.
We unfortunately are out of time. We're going to bring you back to talk more about those other 10 or so championships we didn't get to. Rick Riley, as always, thank you so much. Up next here for us, a fascinating new memoir that is going to be from a very familiar face. It reveals all kinds of raw and surprising details. You won't want to miss it.
Now streaming exclusively on Max, a new CNN flash doc about the album that has Nashville talking, Call Me Country. Beyonce and Nashville's Renaissance. Watch it at max.com/callmecountry. Max subscription required.